So the only line you're going to say in this intro is, Brian, that's a chocolate bunny. And I'm not giving you any other context for it.
Let's go.
Okay.
We really should start recording these.
We should. Absolutely.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome, welcome to the Magic Hour here at Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Reject's cult and exploitation film cast that roars with fiery delight over the films that don't always get their deserved moment in the sun. I am your host, Brian Salisbury. Hello. And I am joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host, screenwriter, slash novelist, slash dude with hair, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Dragons! Motherfucking dragons! God damn it, dragons!
Here.
Holy shit, dragons!
So many dragons.
Dragons. So many dragons.
So this episode is all about Khaleesi. We're talking about the Targaryen family.
Khaleesi.
Oh, wait a minute. No, we talk about movies.
No.
So you know that's not what it's about. Anywho, I want to remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. Our entire back catalog is there, so you can listen to hours and hours and hours of this. Aren't you lucky?
Of us drinking and rattling on.
Yep, pretty much. We're also on Twitter if you want to follow us at Junk Food Cinema, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And then any movie we talk about, we always put up these Amazon links. If you would be so kind, if you're going to buy anything from Amazon, maybe not even necessarily that movie, go ahead and click that link to get there. It doesn't cost you anything. And then whatever you buy, we actually get a little portion of. So we really do appreciate that.
You help pay the bills.
Exactly. So we are in the midst of a continuing cultural phenomena. Very well. It is a shift in the artistic landscape that will forever be marked as one of the greatest eras in film, and I am referring, of course, to the McConaissance.
Seek it, find it, live it.
All right. Is that our jingle?
No, it's not. I should make a jingle. I really should. You know, here at Junk Food Cinema, we pride ourselves at being at the forefront of burgeoning trends. I mean, having our fingers on the pulse of the nouveau. This is obviously why we laugh our asses off during Can't Stop the Music and discuss the finer points of Battle Truck for 20 minutes. Because we're cutting edge. Because that's exactly how I would define us, in no way, shape, or form. However, that's not the point. Matthew McConaughey has gone from being an industry punchline to one of the most sought-out, respected actors in the biz, and this month, we are celebrating our favorite McConaughey genre films. That's right, ladies and gentle spoons, it's McGenre-hey.
McGenre-hey!
All right.
It's a wazzy, it's a woozy, it's a...
Bring down the beast!
Matthew McGenre.
Oh my god, I did make a jingle. I completely forgot. I hope you guys enjoyed that.
So, you know, here's the thing, though. I feel like you truncated that a little bit.
I did.
He went from being the hot new actor to being a well-respected actor to being a Hollywood punchline.
Sure.
Where he crossed this line of demarcation, I believe, 2002.
Yeah.
And then he had the Matthew McConaughey renaissance, which is where he came back and all of a sudden started doing all this respectable stuff again. And this show will ignore that bleak period because we averted our eyes.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't exactly avert my eyes. I saw all those movies. I knew that eventually he would pull himself out of the bong and come back to acting because he was just too fucking talented. But there's this amazing period of time before that, before mm-hmm. he went off and did movies that were on the beach so that he could pull up his Airstream and camp out and hang out with his friends. And before that, he was doing all sorts of interesting genre films.
Yes.
Like really interesting genre films. You know, he was doing submarine movies and dragon movies and horror movies and just crazy stuff that was tasking his acting.
Yeah.
And then he got lazy. And he did a few semi-interesting things in the lazy period, but most of it was very much, I'm going to go hang out on a beach and take my shirt off.
You got to see that movie Sahara. I don't even think I saw that movie. No.
But, I love Sahara.
Oh, that's too bad. But Clive Cussler is rolling over.
Interesting things. I was referring to Sahara.
Were you really? You were referring to Sahara?
I like Sahara a lot.
Oh, man. I don't know how to talk
I'm
to
not
you,
alone man. Either, but I love how you're McConaughey. Like,
it sounds like Bill Clinton. I know. Shut up. The point is, there are two points I want to make. One, you can't call it the Renaissance, because that reminds me that Renee Zellweger has a new face. And two, that period...
I was specifically going to mention not to do Renee Zellweger jokes or Lincoln jokes, because that would tell everyone exactly when this was recorded. Because if we don't put this up right away... If this one waits a couple weeks, people are going to be like, really? They're still making Renee Zellweger
jokes?
I want
to point you again to the fact that we talked about Battle Truck for upwards of 20 minutes.
I would remind you that we're going to talk about a Renee Zellweger film here very soon.
I understand this, but my point being that no one listens to the show and thinks, these guys really are topical. So if they're talking about it right now...
They certainly have their thumb on the pulse of this country.
That's what I'm saying. We're very nouveau. It's like, if we're talking about something right now, you can guess, and with probably 75% accuracy, that it's something that happened at least 10 years ago.
I think that the country's going to come around on Battle Truck, though. I think
we're hoping
there's
for that.
We're leading the charge.
There's
going to be a big push, and all of a sudden, we're going to be like, we were there first.
We
talked Battle Truck.
Get out there and vote with your money, folks. Buy those non-existent DVD copies of Battle Truck, and let's get this thing changed. Let's turn the tide of cinema once and for all.
Someone's going to remake Battle Truck? I don't know. It could be someone in this room.
No, I'm not saying. Stop that. All right.
I'd love to remake Battle Truck.
Oh, is Benedict Cumberbatch going to be in it? See, there's another topical thing that. Okay, now we're just. That may or may not be true. That may or may not be true. What the hell were we talking about?
Matthew McConaughey. Matthew McConaughey. Hey. Matthew McConaughey.
I remember the second thing I wanted to bring up is that the shame time that you're talking about is when he was in all these movies with fucking Kate Hudson,
which I refer to
as the Hudson schlock, and that's why he fell off the radar for a while.
He did a movie with what's her name too?
What was Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yeah, Failure to Launch. No, but it wasn't just that. I mean, he did Surfer Dude. I mean, it was really any time that he could either just do a romantic comedy or wander out to a beach somewhere, he did it. And yes, Fool's Gold happened, and we'll pretend
it happened to all of us, and there was nothing we could do about it.
Yeah, and yes, we know How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days happened as well. These are things that
lose Brian 10 minutes into your movie.
It is, you know, there is a big gaping black hole of time in his life that I hope he enjoyed. And he dated a lot of very beautiful women at the time. He traveled around his hair stream, smoked a lot of pot, and he had a great time. I hope that was all worth it, because now we have the actor back. But
listen,
we are not talking about when he came back.
No.
We're talking about the time before the dark time.
We're talking about the time before the time. We are talking, and incidentally, if you want to talk about Matthew McConaughey's black hole, just give him some weed and some bongos.
Ba-da-ba-ba-da-bop.
But, as we said before, as much as it sounds like we did this podcast just to rip on Matthew McConaughey, we actually love the guy.
We love McConaughey. It was when I say avert my eyes, that's exactly what I did. I ended up writing a piece at one point for film.com in the early days of film.com.
I remember when that was a website.
I remember that was a website. I remember when that was a website coming back, and I was like, really? You're going to pay me how much, and you're going to be around for how long? Yeah, I'll...
In movies, we call that a ticking clock.
Yes, so that was one of those jobs where I was like, yeah, I'll write whatever you want. And so they asked me to write about the Matthew McConaughey's career and breaking it up. And I was like, oh, hell yeah, because there are two periods at that point. And it was writing about the line of demarcation in 2002 and how much I loved that period before and how much I was wishing he would pull himself out of this other period. And it took him a long time.
Yeah,
it really did. And it was one of those where we averted our eyes and I never had written him off. I knew that he was talented enough to come back. Many actors have done it. Many actors have gone through their lazy periods or their dark periods or whatever, because we're people. You know, you get to a point where you say, yeah, I spent 10 years of my life busting my ass doing all these cool fucking movies and nobody went and saw them. So what did I do? I got lazy. I hit the pipe. I hung out with beautiful actresses on a beach and they paid me even more. And who gives a shit? And then you get to a point where it's like, oh, it turns out if you do that long enough, nobody calls you to do those movies anymore. So yeah. Then all of a sudden he got his soul back and is like, I'm going to do all sorts of really cool, daring shit again. And it's like, this is the fucking guy we fell in love with. Here's an Oscar and we'll look the other way when you do your Lincoln commercial.
And Jim Carrey will not subscribe to that looking the other way situation.
You know, it's funny. I'm totally fine with the Lincoln commercial. Like, it's one of those things where people are like, you know, he won an Oscar and then he does a Lincoln commercial. It's like, do you know how little money he made for that movie? Like, that movie had such a low budget that they had problems giving Oscars to its makeup department because its makeup department didn't exist.
So because the makeup department didn't have enough money, Jared Leto actually had to get AIDS. Like, that is how low the budget was. They actually had to give Jared Leto AIDS.
Hollywood is all about giving it to him. They were like, dude, we've met you here.
Oh my god,
that was a little dark.
Seriously,
I usually don't get that dark.
Someone in this room's not over Switchback yet.
Someone has heard some behind the scenes stories.
Anywho, kicking things off on McGenre Hey, we're aiming right for the heart of the beast with one of my favorite sci-fi actioners of the aughts. And I am speaking, of course, about Reign of Fire.
Oh, fuck yes.
I saw the first. But soon the world saw millions. A species which had burned the dinosaurs to dust. Whose ash had brought on ice ages.
And now listen, Cargill and I both love post-apocalyptic films. And between John Carpenter, George Miller, and the entire nation of Italy, the 80s were full of disastrous occurrences, both on screen and off.
Yeah.
And we've seen the world destroyed by war. We've seen the world destroyed by zombies, sentient robots, aliens. But Reign of Fire introduces possibly the coolest instrument of Armageddon I've ever fucking seen, dragons.
Motherfucking dragons.
Motherfucking dragons. I love the idea that dragons rise, feed like mad, burn the earth to a cinder, and then hibernate until it replenishes.
They rise, they burn the earth to ash, they eat the ash, and then they go back.
They can eat ash. They also eat people. And ash is made of people. Oh my god, it's Soylent Ash! They just like their people a little more well done than most of us, I think, is what that boils down to.
It's all about eating the ashes.
Yeah. I mean, now, it's about as scientifically sound as the notion that Mountain Dew makes you sterile, but it does, if nothing else.
Although I would argue that there's plenty of evidence that Dr. Pepper might hurt reproduction in some way, shape, or form.
I will say that people...
I said Dr. Pepper, I mean Mountain Dew.
Yeah, I knew what you meant. But I will say this about that whole theory. There are a lot of people I know that's only drink, exclusively drink Mountain Dew that I hope don't reproduce.
Well, but that's part of the thing.
But I think...
Those are the people that drink it. That's the evidence. I mean,
those people are the most extreme.
They're extreme!
Extreme. I don't know how we got on Mountain Dew, but here we are.
Really, we're bagging on Mountain Dew.
I guess so. I don't know what's going on with us today.
And you went for a Renee Zellweger joke.
I did.
It's a weird day.
It is a very weird day. But what I will say about this idea of dragons living and hibernating and only coming out every few thousand years is that it lends an intriguing new context to them as myths, as why you have all of these different nations across the planet throughout history that have their own dragon myths and where they come from.
Ancient man. I made them into myths, but nature made something far more terrible.
And so, if nothing else, I liked that conceit as a possible new context to the creation of myth, you know?
Yeah, no, it is. It's a fantastic idea. This entire film, this is one of those films I never quite got why it never caught. I saw the first trailer for this thing. I lost my fucking mind. I watched that trailer every goddamn day for 2 fucking months. Like, my wife is like, me and my wife, we hadn't been married. We weren't married at the time, but we were living in the same house together in separate rooms.
Sinful!
In separate rooms.
Sure you were.
No, seriously.
Comma, mom.
No. No, but we lived in this house together, and she would hear the trailer. And she's like, "Are you watching the Reign of Fire trailer again?" I'm like, "Motherfucking dragons! God damn it!" And so I went in to that movie, and I was just like, "Holy shit, mother!" Like, somebody took money. It was the first time anyone had put money into a real fucking dragon film since Dragon Slayer. Now, some of you are gonna go, No, I am going to talk. No. The Sean Connery movie doesn't fucking count. We are not going to talk about it. We will not even name it by name, Brian.
It is the last one that we will. It's the last reference we'll ever make to that movie.
That was a movie that broke my heart in a way that I cannot share.
The only dragon movie that rivals this one for me, and you're going to be surprised, The Last Dragon.
Not a dragon movie.
But it is The Last Dragon.
Have you seen Dragon
Slayer? Show enough.
Oh. Dragon Slayer.
Yeah, I like Dragon Slayer's effects. I like the actual design. There's so much dead air in that movie.
Dragon Slayer's so good. Fuck
so
you.
So much dead air.
My God, I love Dragon Slayer. We're going to get drunk and watch it together, and you're going to appreciate it.
I've seen the fucking movie.
You're going to watch it again.
I need to be drunk before I will come over. I love that you're holding beer cans at me and saying, come over to the dark side.
Come over to the side of us that loved Dragon, that grew up with Dragon Slayer, that watched it when we were 7 years old and loved it. It blew my mind. And I wrote one of the most effusive reviews I've ever written in my entire history.
And that's saying something.
So effusive that somebody actually, the review came out before, Blue Crush, you know, the movie Blue Crush came out. Somebody took my review and took out the word dragons and subbed in the word surf girls and submitted it to Ain't It Cool as a review for Blue Crush. And Moriarty was like, this is so fucking funny. I have to put it up. and put it up and said, apologies to Massa Worm.
Hilarious plagiarism.
But I thought this was hilarious. And everybody thought that was my review for fucking Blue Crush.
Such plagiarism. Funny.
Which, by the way, had until its release was previously titled Surf Girls. It was literally one of the most effusive things I've ever written in my life. And because it was like, holy fuck, motherfucking dragons. The dragons look awesome. The characters are awesome. It is probably, in terms of focusing on the darkness of a post-apocalyptic world, it is probably the closest you get to really kind of feeling how dire that situation is. Yeah. I mean, most of the stuff that happens in the first act of this movie is because they've made a schedule on how much they can eat.
Yeah.
And how they've rationed everything out and said, look, we can only eat this much at this time, and we've got it all out so we can all live. And people are like, we're wasting away. We're starving here. My kids have to eat. I'm going. I'm walking out of here, and it's like, the dragons are going to kill you and burn our crops. Fuck you, my kids. And it's like, it's really kind of brutal stuff where even the guys that you're supposed to hate for doing what they're not supposed to do, you're kind of like,
you get it. You understand their motivation for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You're in a fucked up place, but it gets all of those elements right. Mm-hmm. And I just don't understand why this film never caught.
I have a theory that involves what was going on when it was released, and I'll get to that in a minute. But I want to talk really quickly about two things. One, this is one of the few movies in which we get to see Christian Bale have his actual fucking accent. You think about all the movies that Christian Bale's been in, so many of them require him to, if not completely Americanize himself, then at least hide his Welsh accent. And I think it's great that in this movie, which is, you know, takes place in England, was shot in Ireland, you know, he gets to have his accent, and it's just so refreshing to hear him speak. Actually, I was watching this with a friend, I was watching this with my brother and then a friend of my brother's, and I said that, and he goes, wait, I thought Christian Bale was from like Iowa. And I was like, nope, he is from Wales, actually. No. So, like, but that's the thing, is like, people, especially like contemporary audiences, are just bombarded with American accent Christian Bale. So there's probably a whole cadre of people growing up who think that Christian Bale is from Iowa or is from somewhere on the East Coast.
No, but let's take a moment to revel in the sheer awesomeness of this cast.
True story.
At which point, Matthew McConaughey is the big star in this movie.
Yes, he's. It's the funny thing is, like, the top billed star in this movie is Christian Bale, followed by Matthew McConaughey, and then third billed in the movie,
who was nobody at the time, who had yet to fucking do the steroids and get the abs and fucking go all out with the Spartans, fucking Gerard Butler.
Gerard Butler is third billed in this movie.
Gerard Butler is the Willie Ames of this movie. He's Christian Bale's comic relief, for fuck's sake.
He just goes around hoping Christian Bale's not going to get zapped by a dragon.
There is, oh my God, this, and the thing is that's what he does, but he does it so well. Mm-hmm. Like, this is that movie that you could totally see why, you know, someone like Zack Snyder would be like, oh, I fucking love that guy in that movie. The movie with the dragons. Yeah, let's get that guy. He would be great. No, I mean, it's, you know, there's an amazing scene in this movie where Christian Bale and Gerard Butler are performing a play.
Oh my God, I love
that
scene.
For the kids.
Okay, so one of the other things we don't think about typically with post-apocalyptic films, because most of them are either made in the 80s or, you know, like, we don't think about how our reliance on, and especially film geeks like us, like, our reliance on being able to watch the things that we love. And then the thought of that being taken away entirely. So in this scene, Gerard Butler and Christian Bale are entertaining all the little kids who, incidentally, every post-apocalyptic film has its doomsday date. You know, it happened a lot in the Italian movies, like 2019 yeah. after the fall of New York, 2020 Texas Gladiators. Like, there was always a year, and it was always sometime after 2000, or it was actually
1992 Bronx Wars.
Yeah, there you go. But in this movie, it's 2008. In 2000, the movie was actually made in 2002, but the date of the Dragon Armageddon is 2008.
Was what, November 3rd, 2008?
Something like
that's
that.
When the dragon rose up yeah. and ate the earth and all the good conservatives were saved. And
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, Bill O'Reilly's dragon Reign of Fire. But then, so the movie picks up, like the actual majority of the movie takes place in the year 2020. So it's been 12 years that people have been living under the yoke of the dragon invasion. And so these kids
you can say Obama.
Yes. Truther. The dragons are just truthers. So these kids who are watching them perform.
Every time I see the 2008, that just makes me giggle. It's like, wow, this was like written by a Republican before.
Well, do you remember
we saw the future?
Remember when we saw Death Race, the remake of Death Race 2000, which yeah. was actually made in 2008? And they were like, in 2008, the economy crumbled. It's like, we didn't even make it that far, guys. I'm sorry. You're being a little optimistic. What the fuck was I talking about? Oh yeah, so they're performing a scene from Star Wars. It's the end of Empire Strikes Back, and they're doing it as a play. And at the end of it, one of the kids says, "Did you make that up?" And Christian Bale goes, "Of course I did." Because these kids are younger than 12, so they literally were born in a world that Star Wars doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. And that is terrifying to me.
What's amazing about that scene, what makes that scene just ring and pop and is the soul of that first act, is that, you know, it's the scene where Luke and Darth Vader are fighting in Empire out on that bridge. And he's like, "Luke, I am your father." You know, it's the Luke, I'm your
it's
father.
It's the big reveal of the franchise.
And you watch all the kids go, but they're not calling him Darth Vader. He's the Dark Knight.
Yeah. And, which is funny enough.
And which has its own humor to it.
There you go.
But it's so. It's just such a human moment, and it's so good, and you can see Christian Bale and Gerard Butler having the best time with this scene, mm-hmm. in a way that just makes you fall in love with these dudes and want to see these dudes make it to the end of the fucking movie.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's a really beautiful scene. There's a lot of little, that's the thing about this movie, is of all the films of McGenre that we're going to talk about, well, probably until the end of the first 3 weeks of McGenre, hey, it is probably the most B movie reminiscent of the films we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And yet there are all these little moments that have real emotional weight to them. And surprisingly so, like, there are probably people that would argue the movie doesn't need to have as much emotional significance as some of these moments have. But frankly, I think that's the reason why this is so much better than it has any right to be. Like, somebody literally
just said, we are never using that phrase.
I'm sorry. It's a movie about dragons taking over the world.
And like, it's fucking awesome.
And I'm not saying it's not.
It has every right to be awesome because motherfucking dragons, goddammit, Brian.
All right. Really? So
yes. Really. Yes.
So the Sean Connery movie about dragons had every right to be awesome too, right?
Shh.
Yeah, exactly.
It was supposed to be awesome, and it wasn't.
Yes.
I know stories about that fucking movie, goddammit.
You know stories about every movie.
It was supposed
Pipe
to be
down.
Done by Henson, for fuck's sake. And Clive Owen stood in for fucking what's-his-nuts on that movie.
What? Dennis Quaid's the star of that movie.
Yes, and yeah. in the original picks, in the original tests, Clive Owen was the actor they brought in to test for him.
See, and again, all of this just leads me to believe that movie had no right to be any good,
But it wasn't any good, but it had every right to be good because there were great people attached to it. This had every right to be awesome and every right to be embraced, and we did not embrace it. God damn you, people out there who did not embrace this.
We're yelling at people a lot today.
I love this movie.
We should probably pare down our drinking.
Really love this movie. No, seriously. Reign of Fire is one of my deep-fried favorites that it's one of those
more like deeply charred favorites, I would say.
This is one of those movies that I bring up and I just get dirty looks from people. And it's like as often as I go, hey, you know, it's everybody has their own taste. With this movie, I'm like, no, fuck you. Like
this is the one.
Like
this is the line in the sand.
This is the line in the sand for me. Reign of Fire is a really bold fucking movie that doesn't do anything wrong. Like
That is true. That is true.
I get that it might not be your thing, but to relegate this movie to being shit or boring is fucking garbage.
It's wrong. It's categorically wrong. And then into the story, literally astride a tank rides the most badass Matthew McConaughey we have ever seen on film.
And we'll never see again. Like he literally, to prepare for this film, he went out to a farm and threw bales of hay and pushed shit around. Like he literally spent like 6 months of his life getting into the best shape of his life, fucking getting ripped. And holy God, when he rolls up, it's like, this motherfucker would kill me. Like, you never thought that about Matthew McConaughey and would never think it again. Like, Matthew McConaughey is not what you would call an intimidating dude.
No, he's wispy most of the time is the word I would probably use. But
God.
In this movie... Yeah, in this movie, there's literally a scene where he steps down off the tank and he's rolled up to the fortress, the stronghold, where Christian Bale and Gerard Butler have kind of like the last pocket of Northumberland's, you know, civilization. And they you know, so McConaughey and his crew roll up there and he steps down off the tank and they've all got their guns trained on him. And then to show that he's not carrying anything, he keeps spinning around. But in my mind, what that scene is actually saying is like, y'all see the work I've been doing for the last few months? Check this shit out, man.
That's kind of what
that is. Check this shit out. It's pretty good, all right?
Oh, my God.
Full disclosure, didn't even know I was in a movie. Just thought I'd go throw some bales of hay for a while, get really stoned. But what I love most about Matthew McConaughey's character in this movie is that despite the fact that this takes place in England, it was shot in Ireland, they found the last Texan on the planet. And of course he's played by Matthew McConaughey. I mean, at this point, Matthew McConaughey is the filmic representative of the state of Texas. Like, he can stand in for the... That's, like, after the apocalypse, they find one Texan left on the whole planet. He's in England, and it's Matthew McConaughey.
Dude, the guy is our Austin representative in the world.
Exactly.
I mean, hell, he just did that Lincoln commercial that everyone's kind of giving him a hard time for. He's driving around Austin.
At 5 miles.
Like, most people are like, oh, he's driving around L.A. It's like, no, look at the buildings. That's fucking awesome.
My favorite line of that parody with Jim Carrey that really kind of nails Austin a little bit is like... Why would you do that? Unless you were an Uber driver. Because it's like, yep, I can tell you from firsthand experience, that's exactly why
Most of the Austin film geeks have all become Uber drivers.
Yeah, because it's just, we can work at our own schedule and we make money. So hell yeah, we'll do that. But that is neither here nor there.
Says Uber driver Brian.
Says Uber, so if you need a ride and you're in the Austin area, look me up. But as Gerard Butler puts it, and I love this line, he says it's the only...
Gerard Butler, now Uber driver.
Now Uber driver. After Gamer, is now an Uber driver.
After a lot of movies.
He's so good in this movie, though. I will tell you this.
Yeah.
He's so good in this movie that I actually forgive Gamer. I'm just going to put that out in the universe.
Yeah, no, he did a lot of really bad movies, and yet the minute he shows up on the screen, it's like, oh, God, I love this Gerard Butler. Like, if this Gerard Butler showed up in most movies, I'd be all about it.
I just had an epiphany. I just realized Gerard Butler in this movie... is Matthew McConaughey in most of his movies. He's this laid-back, like, best friend character who all he does, if you watch that movie, all he does the whole time is bang chicks. He just hangs out. He, like, oh, yeah, let's do Star Wars, man. That sounds like fun. I'm going to bang this chick. Now I'm going to bang this chick. I just kind of hang out.
I love Bill Clinton.
Fuck you. But he is the Matthew McConaughey character in most movies, except that he happens to be, you know, Scottish in this movie. But he has a great line. As the tanks are rolling up, he goes, the only thing worse than dragons, Americans. And it's like, yeah, we do kind of suck. But I just realized something else. He's not even third build. Gerard Butler's not even third build.
No.
He is fourth build behind the female actress in the movie. What is her name? Isabella Skorupko, who the only other movie I've ever seen her in is GoldenEye. She was the main Bond girl in GoldenEye.
Yeah.
And she gets higher billing than Gerard Butler. It's kind of amazing.
Nobody knew who he was at this point. This is pre-300.
And then for a very brief moment at the beginning of the movie, we also have an appearance by Alice Krieg.
Yep.
So, yeah, this movie does have a pretty incredible cast. And going back to McConaughey, don't get me wrong, he is chewing scenery like it's tobacco.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he is loving every inch of this character that he's playing. He's larger than life. He's like a larger than life bedtime story that these people would tell their children about what a man from this mythical, lawless frontier called Texas would be like if such a place ever existed.
Yeah, but that's the point of that character. You know, this is not the story of the legend. This is the story of the town that the legend goes through, which is one of the things I love about this. And I love about the arcs of its characters is, you know, McConaughey in that character in almost any other movie would be the lead, but he's not. He's the support.
Yeah.
Because this is all about this guy, the guy who we always shit on in most of these films, which is the guy who just really loves his community and has taken that burden upon himself and is doing what is necessary to keep everyone alive for as long as possible. He's not the sexy hero. He is playing the guy who has the burden of leadership.
See, and incidentally, what's so great about McConaughey's character is that initially you think he's just somebody in there to create havoc, when really he's exactly the same character to a different group of people.
Yes.
So you realize that these two guys who were at first at odds with each other to the point that there's a pretty brutal hand-to-hand fight scene between the two of them, you realize they're exactly the same. And there is a great scene that illustrates this. It's right after Woody Harrelson. What the fuck is wrong with me? Right after Matthew McConaughey's folks have taken down a dragon, and the people in Christian Bale's camp are celebrating. They're having this big party. They're playing, you know, a little too on the nose. They're playing Jimi Hendrix, "Let Me Stand Next to Your Fire." But Matthew McConaughey comes in and he's like,
"Envy the country that has heroes."
And everybody cheers, and he's like,
"I say pity the country that needs them."
Then he goes on this whole tear about, "Why are you celebrating? I lost people today. You know, this is one dragon. If we keep up at this pace, it'll take us 320 years. And there's tears in his eyes. And you realize that he is, you know, these people that he's rolling with are soldiers. They are prepared every moment to die. And yet every time he loses one, it is heartbreaking for him.
Yeah.
And there's like tears welling up in his eyes as he's... And again, like you think about this being a very B-movie reminiscent type film, and yet it has these moments of real emotional significance.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. A little history on this. This was
based... The history of the dragons.
No. This script is notorious. The script that this movie was based on was apparently 400 pages.
Jesus.
And was called Where Eagles Dare. And it was this ridiculously long, huge fucking epic that's unfilmable, that they went and pared down into this really great honed narrative. But apparently, you know, the script, I've heard about this 400-page script. And it's kind of legendary, you know, in the community, as opposed to just kind of how wacky it is and how that movie got made. Because clearly somebody actually saw this and said, "Oh, no fucking way." And then looked at it and said, Oh shit. There's actually a really good story in here. We just need to start, you know, take an X-Acto knife to entire sections of this.
Mm-hmm.
What they end up with is a movie that has all the best scenes from an epic.
Mm.
And I almost kind of wish it had half an hour more to have taken it to epic levels to maybe, you know, I think it's the perfect length. It works perfectly for me. I love the film that came out of that process. But I feel like if it were half an hour longer, people would have seen it as an epic and would have given over given over themselves to moments like that, which are really great. That moment at the fire when he's like admonishing them, because they're all into it. They're like, "Holy shit, We just killed a dragon. Yeah. And he's very politely telling him, you didn't kill shit. My guys who died killed shit.
Yeah.
And that is nothing because there are millions of these fuckers. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you realize very quickly that he is not the villain. And that, like I said, that him, he and Christian Bale are so very much alike. And I want to talk for a minute about the look of this movie, because it kind of plays into, you know, we're coming off our series about horror movies in the 90s. And one of the things that I noticed watching a lot of movies from the 90s and just watching a lot of movies in general is that, you know, it's not across the board, but there are a lot of movies within a given decade that kind of are assigned their own hue. Like, certain movies from certain eras have, like, a particular color palette.
Oh, yeah.
So, movies from the 90s, a lot of movies, like I said, I'm not saying all of them. You can't really have a broad stroke thing like that. But a lot of movies from the 90s have a very, like, autumnal color palette.
Very sepia.
Yeah.
You look at, like, one of them that we didn't talk about last month, Vampires.
Yeah.
Where they actually start, you know, they're, like, painting onto the fucking camera to give that yellow tone to the sky for no apparent reason.
It's a lot of deep yellows. It's a lot of tans. It's a lot of burnt oranges. Like, it's just, it's very, like I said, it's very autumnal. And then in the early 2000s, you had your choice between this weird sort of green color, and then you also had like this blue-gray, just very like a rainy day in Bristol. You know, it was like this very blue-gray tone.
The blue-gray was kind of the big budget look.
Yes,
and the green
look
was the low budget look.
Exactly.
Like Saw was the movie that kind of brought that green to the forefront,
right.
And then we saw so many imitators imitating that style.
Yeah, and when you watch Reign of Fire, that blue-gray makes so much. They actually find a way to use that in a way that it's not just because this is what movies look like, but specifically because it serves a story. I mean, not only because it's taking place in Northumberland, the least sunny place on the planet, but also because, I mean, we're dealing with a society where, you know, they say in the prologue that one of the things the dragons have done throughout the ages is that they killed the dinosaurs and their ash brought on an ice age. So it's adversely affecting the atmosphere and would cause that sort of like permanent overcast situation. And it's not until the end of the movie that color palette breaks and it becomes bright blue and sunny again. And I think that's so interesting that it's like you watch all of these movies from this period of time, and a lot of them, it's almost like, automatic response. It's like, oh, this movie, it's a big budget movie. It has this color palette. And this one, it's like they actually took the time to think about whether or not it made sense. And even though they ended up using the same color palette as a lot of movies from this time, there's an actual function to it. And then I realized I had watched this movie way too many times. Because now I'm looking at the fucking color palette of Reign of Fire.
Because this is a movie you watch that many times.
I do.
This movie's fucking great.
Yeah. And the action sequences in this movie, holy cow. Like, we're talking about a film that didn't have, you know, an enormous budget. You know, I mean, it had a decent budget for sure.
You know, let me interrupt for a second.
Please.
I've just realized we've gotten this far into this.
Mm-hmm.
We have not actually told anybody what this is about. We've assumed that they've just fucking watched
this. Well, we said dragons.
We said dragons.
This is about dragons. Like, so, end of the world because of dragons. Go.
It's a little... So this is, we've gone, you know, this might be a little late for this.
I'm going to say we're almost at the end of the episode.
For those
the plot, I guess we should explain.
For those of you who have, you know, missed, you know, are like, really, Reign of Fire? I heard about that movie, but I never fucking watched it. It's about one of the last bastions of civilization holding up in a castle after the dragons have wiped out most of humanity. The dragons have burnt most to ash, eaten the ash. The dragons are starving. They're going after whatever's left. And here's these people trying to live in a dark corner of the Ireland, and are just trying to eke by an existence, just getting by and not being eaten by dragons. And the dragons come, the dragons fuck them up, and then the fucking American military shows up and says, "We're taking volunteers." Okay, no volunteers. We're taking volunteers.
We're just taking people now.
And then they go off because they have found what they believe will bring about the end of dragonkind. And they have a plan and they've worked it out. They just need bodies. And so they go off to do it. And we tell this, you know, we're watching the story of this guy who, played by Christian Bale, who's in charge of keeping all these people alive.
Yeah. And he happened to be someone who was there when the first dragon kind of came up from the depths. So he has a personal, you know, affiliation with the apocalypse. And so we watch him. His whole goal in life is just to survive. Matthew McConaughey, on the other hand, he wants to keep his people alive, but he also is he's a military guy, so he's actively fighting against the threat. And that's what military guys do.
And his whole thing is, I'm going to save humanity.
Yes. Like,
it doesn't matter you know, I may die flying through the air with an axe in my fucking hand, but I am going to save humanity.
You know, I read your review of Blue Crush, and my favorite scene in that movie is when Kate Bosworth jumps off a smokestack with a battle axe and a dragon eats her.
She's never been hotter.
And a surfer girl eats her. It's amazing. Oh my god.
A motherfucking surfer girl, man. Holy shit.
But yes, as Cargill stated, that's the plot of the movie. I mean, like we said before, it really is a post-apocalyptic film structure into which the threat, the instrument of the Armageddon, is dragons, and then the conflict between Christian... I actually was impressed with how quickly the conflict between Christian Bale and Matthew McConaughey became a collaboration, and it's like, okay, how do we stop this? Because they figure out that there's only one male dragon, and it lives in London, and it's fertilizing all the eggs. It's actually...
It was called Colin Farrell.
I was... Right? Hey-o! Funny enough, like, the end conceit of this movie, the third act twist of... Not twist, but really the turn of the movie in the third act, reminded me a lot of what you find out about dragons in How to Train Your Dragon, which Gerard Butler does a voice for, which was a really weird kind of bridge. But so they go to London, and that's where the climactic action sequence happens. But before that, the Archangel stuff is so fucking cool.
Holy shit.
So they, like, Matthew McConaughey's crew, they're called the Archangels. They parachute out of helicopters. Already awesome.
Yes.
And they fly, like, right amongst the dragons in the sky, and they use these giant versions of gladiator nets to try and bring them down, and then Matthew McConaughey just fucking hits them with a +4 battle axe.
Yes.
That he got from somebody, you know, playing Dungeons & Dragons level 27, and it's just like, oh my god, this is fucking amazing. So you have that whole situation, which is just...
There is so much wrong about your Dungeons & Dragons. Yeah,
it's okay, nerd. It's okay, go to sleep. But it's just so much fun. And then at the end, when you have the actual, like... Because there's two different kinds of... There's one practical dead dragon in the movie that looks incredible.
I mean, at +27, you're looking at +4.
Really?
You're well above +5. I mean, you're looking at, like, +6, plus...
We just lost both of the listeners we had, so thank you very much for that. So you have that, and then there's two different, like, there's the CG dragons in the movie, and then there's the one practical dead dragon. And I gotta say, there are a couple of inky, you know, CG things with the dragons early on, but when they're in flight, when they're in the sky, when you're looking at, especially when you're looking at, like, there's a great scene where they come into London, and I gotta hand it to the landscape artists. I mean, there's shots of post-apocalyptic London where every charred spire along the skyline suddenly looks like it's about to take flight because these big wings just start coming off of them, and it's glorious. And then the ending fight between Christian Bale and this like male bull dragon is actually, like, as far as effects go, is really beautifully done. I really love the design of that.
Yeah, no, so many of the effects still hold up.
Yeah.
You know, this is a movie, what was it? It was 2002,
2002,
right?
Yeah.
So we're looking at a movie 12 years old, and visual effects on 12-year-old movies, when you're talking about digital visual effects, it's kind of a rough thing to go up against. I mean, there's a lot of classic movies that we just kind of look the other way. It's like, yeah, we know all those Agent Smiths looked really cool when this movie came out. But not so much anymore.
And the great exception to that rule, still for me, every single day, is Jurassic Park. Because Jurassic Park, it's still difficult for me to see a lot of the scenes on the digital
dinosaurs. Jurassic Park is a perfect example of what you're supposed to do with what Jon Favreau did with Iron Man.
Combined.
Which is combine.
Yeah.
You use practical every chance you can get and use digital
only as an augmentation.
Stuff. Yeah, as an augmentation.
Yes.
And here... you know, for a mostly digital film, these digital effects were done really brilliantly because in rewatching this film recently, it was just like, man, these dragons look so fucking cool. There's so many things from this era that I go back and look at that are just laughable, you know, that you forgive because that's what was available at the time. But these dragons, they fucking hold up, man. They really do.
See, okay. And we were talking earlier about why this movie doesn't... Okay, first of all, before we get there, obviously we hinted at it, but the great scene, the, like, Samuel L. Jackson getting eaten by a shark scene in this movie.
Holy shit.
Is McConaughey trying to fire a magnesium tip arrow into the mouth of the male dragon. It misses, and he gets so pissed off that he literally picks up his axe and just, like, lets out this barbaric yawp and then just jumps off the top
And it's in the trailer.
Yes.
Like, that's, like, one of the things that should be said, this is one of the best trailers ever made.
It does. It's an incredible trailer.
That trailer, just, I'm sure Brian's linked it on this page.
More than likely.
Watch the trailer now. Even if you've seen the movie, even if you hate the movie, watch the trailer. And just, and that moment where McConaughey is like, rah, rah, you're just like, fuck yes, this movie. Fuck yes.
Because he jumps off that smokestack knowing only one of two things is going to happen. The dragon's going to kill him, or he's going to fall to his death. This guy's got giant swinging brass testicles.
Yeah, and that's the moment that really nails this character.
Yes.
That of all the things that you've seen building up to it, that's the moment that you know that this guy's committed, that he is not bullshit, that everything that you may have thought about him from the beginning, he is a fucking John Wayne motherfucker with an axe, only there to kill dragons and save humanity. That's it. Like, if he's gonna die, he's gonna fucking die. Fuck it. But he's gonna die fucking trying to save humanity killing dragons.
Matthew McConaughey is so good that even when he's in a movie with Gerard Butler, he's still the most Spartan character in the movie. Let that sink in for a minute. I'm sorry. That's exactly what that is. That is no fear whatsoever. The greater good is all that matters. The self does not exist. That is a fucking amazing scene. I love that.
Well, he's in a movie with Gerard Butler and Christian Bale, and he's the most badass guy.
And he's the superhero.
Like, you're never going to see him play that character again. Like, he missed that point. He had those years to do those roles and used it with Kate Hudson. And
oh, the Hudson schlock.
But you know what? We got him back.
We did.
We got him back in a big way.
We literally pulled him out of the maw of the failure dragon.
Dude, no. You know what? No. He brought himself back. He did like six great things in a row.
That's true. We had nothing to do.
And like, it was one of those things where it's like, he did the Lincoln Lawyer. It's like, hey, I remember that McConaughey. That's pretty cool. And then he's like, hey, how about this movie Mud? Hey, how about this TV show True Detective? Hey, I'm going to go make a movie where I die of AIDS. What do you think of that, motherfuckers? And you're just like, holy shit.
Preceded by
where the fuck were you? God damn it.
Preceded by a movie in which I play a male stripper doing everything he can to get AIDS and somehow doesn't get AIDS.
He's funny as fucking that.
He's so good. Like, there was literally a gauntlet of films where he dared you not to like it.
Everybody.
He was daring you to say anything negative about his performances. Dude,
and we say this as guys who have been critics. The critics walked into those movies ready to hate McConaughey. They wanted to hate him. And guys like us are just like, come on. Fucking McConaughey's done some good stuff. Give him a shot. And they're like, no, fuck this guy. I've seen Fool's Gold. I went to Failure to Launch. Fuck this guy. And dear God, did he start bringing it back again. But this was, I would argue that Reign of Fire might be his last movie. Where brought this.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
this is like the last one where like he put all that work into it. And I almost think this might be the one that broke him. Like he went out and said, I'm going to get into the best shape of my life. I'm going to put myself into this character. I'm going to do this epic movie and I'm going to be the movie star. I'm going to be fucking Harrison Ford. And then Hollywood was like, oh no. And the audiences were like, yeah, no, we're this whole dragon thing. We don't get it, but you look great. You know, we kind of want to sleep with you, even if we're dudes. And so he's like, well, fuck this. I'm going to stay in this shape. I'm going to smoke out. I'm going to fuck beautiful women. I'm going to drive around in my Airstream. And I'm going to make movies that are fun. Fuck you guys. Yeah. And then eventually he came around and started doing that cool shit again.
Well, okay. So here's the thing. So here is my theory. There are two things that happen historically at around the time this movie was being made that I think really affected it. The first being, you know, like I said, they shot this in England, and they shot it right at the height of the hoof and mouth disease scare. And because of the limitations, it caused limitations as to where they could shoot, which means they actually had to cut a lot of things they wanted to shoot out of the script because they literally just could not. Like, even where they ended up shooting, there was an edict from the local government, like, you can shoot here, but you have to literally clean up, like, you have to leave no footprint whatsoever. So that's going on, and then they can't shoot a lot of the things they want to because of the restrictions around the disease. And then, of course, like we said, it's a British production. You've got the dragon thing that, like, you know, Americans have a sort of hot and cold love affair with, like, Arthurian legend. I don't know. That could have been a factor. But then also, when this movie was going to premiere on TV, it was going to premiere on TV, and right at the date that it was, you know, obviously it had its theatrical run, and then the date that it was supposed, which I know a lot of filmmakers will tell you, sometimes when the movie doesn't do great in theaters, you have that second life.
Yes.
You have that second life on TV, you have that second life on DVD.
You know, great example, classic Austin film, the Office Space.
Yes.
Office Space is a movie that did not do well in theaters, but turned out to be one of the best sellers on DVD in the long term over its lifespan,
yeah,
and was always in print.
So the date that this movie was supposed to air on TV, it's again like the second life, the second chance for this movie. It was July 7th, 2005. ABC was going to show Reign of Fire, but that day the terrorist attack on London happened, and they felt that it was a little inappropriate to show a movie where London burns. So instead they replaced it with Big Fat Liar. Yeah. So that's what people got to watch that day instead of Reign of Fire. This movie never got a fucking chance. Like, from its production to the time it was going to possibly have that Hail Mary pass on TV.
Liar, liar, pants on Reign of Fire.
Oh, boom.
You wish. You thought of that.
No, I'm just sitting here watching Darth Vader going, yes. Or the Emperor just like, good, good.
Let the puns flow through you.
Yes, yes. But yeah, I mean, regardless of the reasons, we love the hell out of this movie. I think most people that have seen this movie, that have given it a chance, feel the same way. I think it's one of those movies that most people who disparage it probably haven't seen it.
You know, and the thing is, I don't think you and I have ever been so equally giddy and excited about a movie in the entirety of this series.
Yeah, probably not since Big Trouble in Little China.
Like, no, even then, like, we weren't giddy like this. Like, this is a movie we're giddy about.
If you have
not seen this and enjoyed it, or you were disappointed on it on its first run and never gave it another chance, this is a movie you need to embrace. You need to give another chance and go, holy shit, this is a movie that actually got made. Like, how the fuck did Disney make a goddamn movie about dragons in a post-apocalyptic era? Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's hard to fathom, but give it a shot. You're going to love it. And, I thought of one other time we were this giddy is when we interviewed Dick Miller, and he literally referred to us as those two giddy guys.
Those two giddy guys, yeah. No, it was Dick Miller, yeah.
No one knew how they spawned so fast. They swarmed like locusts, driven by one purpose. Defeat.
So this brings us to the junk food pairing of the film, and in honor of the eponymous founder of the McGenre Hay Feast, all junk food items connected to movies this month will be beers, because, come on, Matthew McConaughey, a beer,
oh yeah, a joint. Yeah, because beer is what he's into.
I'm just saying, even his fucking Oscar acceptance speech, he talked about drinking beer and eating gumbo, so I'm just saying.
We're doing beers.
We're doing beers. Good. We're doing beers.
There's really no good dragon junk food.
No, well, there's no good one. First up, to complement your viewing of Reign of Fire, the most unabashedly B-movie-esque of the McGenre movies we'll be covering this month, get yourself not one, but an entire sixer of Fin du Monde by Unibrew.
Oh, no.
Unibrew is a Canadian brewery that, much like Fallen, which we talked about in our last episode, came to us in the 90s. And Fin du Monde is a triple-style golden ale whose name literally translates to End of the World, which is exactly what's going on in Reign of Fire. And it's funny enough, I actually thought this was doubly appropriate for like 20 minutes, because I always thought Trois Pistoles, which is another beer of theirs, had a dragon on it. I've been drinking that beer for years. I always thought it was a dragon. It's a fucking Pegasus. On the label, I always thought it was a dragon, but it's actually a Pegasus. But Fin du Monde, End of the World.
I blame you.
Yes, yeah. End of the World, this is one of my favorite apocalypses, because if the world has to go down, it should be burned by dragons.
And it should be drank with Canadian 90s brew.
I agree. So that's going to do it for the show. I want to remind you guys again that we are available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can go back and listen to all of the various series we've done. And then once we're done with McGenre, hey, you can listen to it all at once, which is what you should do. Just have a big old McConaughey party. But
yes.
Yes, that's exactly what you should do.
That shouldn't be done with any irony whatsoever.
No, no, absolutely
McConaughey
not.
Is fucking awesome. He's back and he's fucking awesome. Fuck you.
Yeah. We like McConaughey. Fuck you.
So, we're doing a whole month on McConaughey. So fuck you. Fuck you.
Yes, we're on Stitcher. We're on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/... Or Facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. I don't know what happened there. I had a little mini stroke. And also, please use those Amazon links. We really appreciate it. Cargo, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or at Facebook at Facebook.com/MassaWyrm.
Fair enough. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, or you can also find me on Facebook, Facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic, or please do pop over to my home away from home, which is oneofus.net. Whatever you're passionate about, whatever your fandom is, we've got something for that. A number of podcasts and blogs over there. Good stuff. But yeah, that's going to do it for the first chapter of McGenrehey. So for
expect three more weeks.
Three more weeks.
McGenrehey, motherfucker.
And then a finale that you will not believe. So for Cargo, this is Brian reminding you to dig hard, dig deep, go for shelter, and never look back.